Welcome back to the Emerging Tech Horizons podcast. This is the second part of our two-part episode where we talk to Moshe Schwartz about the National Defense Authorization Act.
All right, so one of the big players in the world of emerging technologies these days in defense industry are small businesses. Whether those are the traditional suppliers of DoD or those new businesses trying to enter the market or those commercial companies springing up in Silicon Valley, Boston, Austin, all over the country. What's in the bill for small businesses?
There are a few provisions. And by the way, every year there is small business language in this bill. Okay, small business is a recurring theme in the NDAA. So I'll just mention a few. One is expanding the mentor-protege program. So the mentor-protege program, in short, is designed to help small businesses by connecting them with larger big businesses so they can be proteges.
So the big guy is the mentor.
Exactly.
And in theory, doing what?
Helping them learn the ropes, right? There are incentives for the large companies to do that, right? They get credit for it. And so this year, it was expanded to cooperative or partnership intermediary agreements. So you can do a mentor-protege arrangement in a cooperative agreement. That didn't exist before.
So what does that do? Okay.
So in a cooperative agreement arrangement, what it does is it allows the small business to still benefit from being connected to a large company when it wouldn't be able to because of just the contract type in essence. So it just opens the aperture for more opportunities.
So even if the small business has some pre-existing work with large businesses, it can still participate in this
yes.
program. Right. What else?
So, and this was in both the House and Senate version. Whenever you see something in both the House and Senate version, you know it really has traction.
You should be deeply suspicious.
Deeply suspicious.
Okay. Right?
You should always be deeply suspicious. But what this one did is it said, if small businesses are not paid within 30 days of when they are supposed to be paid by agreement by a prime contractor, right? So if prime contractor is supposed to pay the small business and they're more than 30 days late from the date that they're supposed to pay, then the contracting officer has some authorities, right? And the biggest authority,
the government
contracting officer can, if they determine it is basically an unjustifiable delay in payment, they could use that in past performance of the prime contractor. Or in other words, they could say, when we are going to award future contracts and look at your performance.
We're looking at your track record.
We're looking at your track record here. Now, there has to be that judgment because sometimes there could be very good reasons why a prime is not paying a subcontractor. The most obvious good reason is there's an actual dispute as to whether the subcontractor performed.
Did the work.
Right. Did you do the work? Did you do it as you were supposed to? Did you deliver it to us on time? Right. So there could be reasons there. But this still gives the contracting officer the authority to basically make that judgment and weigh in and, in short, pressure the prime contractors through the past performance. And the prime contractors are required to work with the contracting officer on the issue. That didn't exist before. So that's another one. I would say another one is there are goals that are aspirational goals, but they're more than just theoretically aspirational for meeting certain thresholds, like what percentage of contracting dollars go to woman-owned businesses, go to minority businesses. This year, they increased the goal for service-disabled veteran-owned businesses.
And is that only in the Department of Defense or across the
federal? That one, I believe, was just the Department of Defense, which that's a great larger question. Because the bill is designed and has a jurisdiction for the Department of Defense, the only way they could be touching other agencies is if other committees in Congress are on board.
Agree.
Right.
You can't slip something in past them.
Not really. Mm-hmm. And not unless they're really sleeping.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Yeah. So if you're trying to get something into the bill of the NDAA, the easiest way to do it is to write it in such a way that it just applies to DOD, because if you start expanding it to other jurisdictions. Now you might have to talk to the Senate Homeland Security. You might have to talk to House Oversight. You might have to talk to small business, which is what we're talking about right now. Now, sometimes those committees will come to you and say, please put this in, because they don't have a bill to do it, like we talked about earlier. But yes, so usually these things are just Department of Defense. And then the other one I want to mention is extending the pilot for streamlining SBIR and SITR transition, right? So that requires DoD to award multiple award contracts for buying technologies, right? So SBIR, that expires every few years.
Small Business Innovation Research Program,
yes,
right?
Yes, and okay. Technology, mm-hmm. Right. That expires every few years and has to be renewed every few years. And we've been doing this for decades, mm-hmm. Right? So that's another one that's, we're gonna have to see that in a couple of years, that one get extended.
And so this one was aimed at helping those research projects get out of the research phase and into further development, potentially even procurement.
Right, because it was only open to SBIR, SDTR projects. So you had to have had one of those in the early phases to be eligible for this. That was the intent.
So, you know, another acquisition provision which may be of interest to the small businesses is something on commercial solutions opening. So there's a Section 813, which is called Focused Commercial Solutions Opening. So what is a commercial solutions opening? And what does this one?
So commercial service openings are very similar to broad agency agreements.
Announcements.
They're very similar to broad agency announcements.
Right.
With the exception that the CSOs are broader. And what I mean by that is they can be used to acquire innovative commercial items. They can be used for technologies or services.
Yeah, because traditionally the broad agency announcements were used for researchy. Things.
Not traditionally, they can only be used for basic.
Legally, they can only be
and applied
used.
Research.
Okay.
So the CSO just, again, opens the aperture. It's opening the aperture for that. And so this type of provision generally will appear when Congress is saying, we gave you this authority, use it. And there's a perception, arguably, that it wasn't being used. So what this provision does is it says, DoD working with the services, you have to at least four times annually do a CSO. Right, and use those authorities. It could be to acquire goods, it could be to acquire services, but you have to use it four times, and it has to be focused at addressing a mission of a geographic combatant command.
So this is back to the needs of CENTCOM, the needs of INDOPACOM.
Correct.
Okay.
Absolutely. So they're doing two things here. They're saying, use the CSO authority, let's broaden the opportunities, and let's focus on the geographic combatant commands.
Now, the CSOs have been used.
Yeah.
I mean, I think most interestingly as part of Operation Warp Speed.
Correct.
And that may be an interesting story for another time, right? But you're saying that there's still some frustration. Hey, this is an interesting, useful authority. Use it more.
Right, or at least use it for the geographic combatant commands.
Right.
And this is not the only provision that talks about geographic combatant commands. There seems to be a theme, and this isn't just for emerging technologies, there seems to be a theme across the NDAA of going down to the combatant command need. So, for example, there is a provision in the NDAA that says the combatant command, certain combatant commands, but primarily the geographic ones, can bring on a person to advise on foreign military sales and security assistance. There is another provision that says the combatant command should get a CFO or someone to help with commercial technology procurement.
Chief Financial Officer,
yes.
Thinking about commercial procurement for the needs
of the geographic combatant commands, because the needs of the Pacific are very different than the needs of Europe. Those are very different scenarios right now. Right? So there's a broader what's going on in the geographic combatant commands. What are their needs?
And this reflects Congress's maybe frustration that they are hearing that the combatant commanders are not getting what they claim they need.
Arguably.
Right. Because sitting between those combatant commanders and the industry folks who provide those things is the set of military departments and the DoD acquisition system.
Well, and geography in reality. I mean, that matters, right? Geography matters. Yes, so what you see is both DoD giving authorities to the combatant commands, right? Like these positions that we talked about. We see them requiring DoD to do certain things for the combatant commands, like here saying use 4 CSOs a year, focus towards that. And sometimes we see them requiring inputs from the combatant commands, like we talked about earlier, the unfunded priorities, which they get from the combatant command.
Is this sort of voice of the customer a little bit?
I would think so. It's getting to the people, right?
Right.
Getting to the people.
So we mentioned earlier the Joint Energetics Transition Office that's mandated in this NDAA, this fiscal year 24 NDAA. What is the, what's the prerogative, what's the right of Congress to reach in and rewicker the wiring diagram of the Pentagon?
It is their prerogative. He who has the gold, right?
And writes the law, I suppose.
And writes the law, makes a lot of the rules, and that is the reality. But that is their prerogative. And it's a prerogative that they use, right? So we talked earlier about the breakup of acquisition technology and logistics into the undersecretaries of research and engineering and the undersecretaries of acquisition sustainment, right? They've done it in a few other important ways, and there were provisions in this year NDAA where they, in some cases, did something, and in other cases, almost did something and chose not to. Mm-hmm. So a number of years ago, Congress set up the chief management officer, right, to try to get a better handle on business operations of the department. And then shortly thereafter, they said, no, that didn't seem to work as we wanted. And they disbanded the office of the chief management officer.
Changed their minds.
In this year's bill, there was language to potentially have it, bring it back. They declined to do that. That was dropped in conference, right? So one wonders what message was being sent there. So that was one example. A number of years ago, in an effort to get a better handle on cost estimating, they took the office that DoD had and they named it basically the CAPE, Cost Analysis Program Evaluation. And they gave it more authorities and a report that they were to get every year on how things were doing and a lot of stuff there. Congress created that office. Absolutely. There was a provision this year that would have diffused a lot of that authority and disbanded it, and they declined to do that. They ultimately said, no, we're not going to do that. But clearly Congress had an issue of what was going on.
In the office?
In the office, and I'm not sure what clearer message you could send than having draft legislation or pass legislation, actually, from one of the chambers. And declining to do it, that is a powerful message of, but we can if we want to. And that's a message that should be listened to. Whatever that is, listen to the message and try to solve that. There were a couple of examples where they did a couple of things. For example, they legislated the establishment of Defense Innovation Unit. Now, they already have the Defense Innovation Unit. So
DIU is the group that works out in Silicon Valley and works with venture-backed firms, emerging new high-tech firms.
Yeah, right. And they're not just in Silicon Valley. They have an office in Austin. They have an office in Boston. They, of course, have an office in D.C. So they're in a lot of those places. They also have some real influence in the department. So, for example, they're leading one of the governance organizations for Replicator.
The drone program.
Yeah,
right.
That Deputy Secretary of Defense Kathleen Hicks
announced at the Emerging Technologies.
She did. Yes, it all comes back together, doesn't it? And so they put that in legislation. Now, one could say, why put it in legislation?
If it already exists.
Well, one thing it does is it doesn't let you disestablish it.
Because you're required to have
it. Because you're required to do it now. Another thing that it does is and I don't know if this was their intent or not, it may have been, is to say, we really like DAU, so I know you established it, but we want to energize it or turbo it or really give them some of the political clout. It does that as well.
So if Congress says there shall be this office, then the Department of Defense at least has to comply to some level and create such an office.
Yes.
If Congress says nothing, the Department of Defense can still create offices as it sees fit to
as
do
they
its
did here.
Job.
Yeah.
Like they did with DIU.
Absolutely. Right. Or the Strategic Capital Office, which is now in legislation because of this year's NDAA.
Right.
They just did that.
I don't think there's actually a piece of legislation that says there shall be a DARPA.
That's an interesting research question. So we'll have to get
I believe the answer is there is not.
That may be.
But it's happily existed for over 50 years.
And doing well without legislation.
Right.
But they do that a lot. Over the last few years, they did that with the Commercial Items Group that they put in DCMA, Defense Contracting and Management Agency. So they do that. How effective the organizations are, as we talked about before, really depends on how much DOD embraces it. But since DOD started Defense Innovation Unit, it's already there.
Yeah, because I could see the reaction from the executive branch side, from the Department of Defense side. Why are you telling us how to organize ourselves? This is not a priority for us like it's you. If you want me to do it, I'll do it. It's almost sort of like a parent talking to a kid at that point. Right? The kid will do it grudgingly.
So that is an interesting metaphor comparing DOD to the kid and Congress to the parent.
That's right.
I love that. But I think that is the point to a lot of it, right? So in industry, companies respond to their consumers or potential markets or to investors. They don't just do things as they want to. They do things because there's an impetus to do that. Because if they fail, if their sales go down, they disappear.
There's the incentive, the negative incentive.
The negative, very negative. Well, it also is a positive incentive of you will get more money.
Right.
There's a very big positive incentive too. That's why people get into business in the first place, right? So there is an outside influence. What does DOD respond to? Who do they have to respond to? It's only Congress. There is no natural, inherent stimulus that will push DOD or force DOD to reorganize. Companies reorganize all the time, right? Now, sometimes you'll get great leaders who will say, yes, we need to do this. But Congress is the only outside force.
I guess, in the nature of a bureaucracy to change itself. And we've talked about
this with
other podcasts on how difficult it is to change a bureaucracy. So what you're saying is the Congress, through the NDAA, can provide that forcing function, splitting that Office of Acquisition and Technology into two, creating this office, disestablishing that office.
And I would suggest that in some cases that they have done that, in hindsight, even DOD leaders were like, yeah, that was really smart, like Goldwater Nichols. Without going too much into Goldwater Nichols and the history of military education,
it's kind of created the structure that we have today and have lived with for multiple decades. And the rules and roles of various players was written into the law.
And it was written into the law with some senior people at DOD kicking and screaming, particularly of note, the Marine Corps Commandant, who said how, and I paraphrase, I don't remember the quote exactly, how this is jeopardizing the entire security of the United States of America.
Right.
And that seems to have been incorrect.
So amazing power sometimes in a few hundreds to thousand pages worth of stuff here. So Congress wrote all this, staffers and members fought its way through markups and floor amendments and a conference process, got signed by the president, it's law. What happens now?
So depending on the provision, right, a lot of provisions require regulation to enact. They virtually all require policy to enact, because in essence, a lot of these are top-level directives, because even if you're doing a pilot program...
Directives from the Congress.
From Congress to the
Department. To the Department of Defense.
Right. Do this.
Signed off by the president.
Absolutely. But there's still details, right? So you have to work out the details, and it's done through both regulation and policy and all that falls under policy and doctrine and all that other stuff. So let's talk about the regulatory process to begin with. Just because something is in law doesn't mean it is being followed. When the regulation comes out implementing that law, that's when people start following it. So if you see a situation, say, but the law says otherwise. But there ought to be a law.
Well, there is a law.
There is a law. But the regulation isn't in place yet, so it's not actually being implemented, executed. And that's not nefarious. That's how the system works.
Right.
Unfortunately, or fortunately perhaps in some cases, we are still promulgating regulation from 2019.
Oh.
So some things haven't gotten in yet. And in some cases, a law has passed. It hasn't been implemented because the regulation is still being drafted, and Congress starts changing it already. So we haven't even caught up with what we've done in the
past. And I would imagine in a few hundred pages of provisions of laws, there's things that are just never done. Yeah. Never followed up on to any real practical extent.
Yes, no, absolutely. And some of them can't be. And some of them get outdated very quickly. And it's so hard to track all these because you mentioned, 2,000 pages of the NDA or something like that. Now multiply that by every year. So over the last 20 years, you're talking about 40,000 pages. How do you track all that, right? It's somewhere in law. Sometimes it's in notes. That's a whole other conversation that will put everyone to sleep. But it's really hard to track. So these regulations is how these get implemented. And that's when the rubber meets the road.
So someone in the Pentagon, some people in the Pentagon are now absorbing all of this stuff in the NDAA.
Yes.
And establishing offices, I assume, getting people to write reports, putting out regulations, whatever they're being told to do. But like you said, sometimes these processes take a long time. And we've seen a few examples in what we've talked about of, well, this is clearly a case of Congress being frustrated with the way things were going. So how is Congress now going to monitor what's happening with the stuff in this?
Not very well. It is very difficult to do that. And it's very difficult to do that for a number of reasons. One is the sheer volume of things to track. One of them is the turnover in Congress of staff and members, right? So institutional knowledge. And one of them is the workload of current issues and crises that need to be dealt with both in the department and Congress that distract from that, right? So you have to put together another NDAA. We do have a couple of wars going on overseas, not that the U.S. is involved in, but supporting, right?
The same staff and committees and members who just put out this product, the FY24 NDAA, are almost immediately turning to
25
NDAA.
Absolutely.
And their inboxes are filled like everyone else's, and
They're supposed to do oversight, right? And they're supposed to communicate with industry and constituents and all of that, which is the role of Congress, absolutely.
So it becomes difficult to watch over. It
becomes very difficult to watch over. But so with regulations, for example, DOD puts out the status of all the regulations, and you can look it up, right? There's a page on the internet that you can go to that DOD keeps updated all of their open cases. There's for the DFARS, Defense Federal Acquisition Regulation, all their open cases and what the status is. There's also a similar page for the Federal Acquisition Regulation, which applies to all of government, right? So the Federal Acquisition.
So you can monitor the progress of the law becoming a regulation, which might affect your company.
Yeah. And it's and here's an important part about that process. Sometimes things are implemented immediately. So, for example, the day of this taping, the provision in the 24 NDAA on acquisition authorities for Ukraine, Taiwan, and Israel, DOD issued a class deviation saying it's now live.
Class deviation is a regulatory statement or something.
Yes, it says that we're not going through the normal regulatory process. We are starting today. So it is now live today, or for those watching, a week ago when we taped this. Right? That's one thing. It's not done very often, but it does happen in certain instances. The other thing can be done is they could do an interim rule, which means we are creating the rule. It starts today. We've drafted and all of that. But there is still a public comment period where anybody in the public can comment.
So that's where industry's voice can be heard.
Yeah. Right. And not just industry, right?
Anyone.
It's open to the public, yeah.
Right.
And they will then take that and consider it, usually put out information on what the comments were. And you can access all the public comments. You can go to public meetings when they have public meetings and see the presentations and access it. And that frequently will, to varying degrees, influence changes to it.
Right.
Or you can go through the regular process. And the regular process is they develop a proposed rule. They put it out for public comment for 30 days, 60 days. They renew it for another 60 days. That can happen all the time.
And these are all ways to execute
always
the policies written into this NDAA.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and I guess from my time on the Hill then, you know, we did spend a lot of time looking back at previous provisions, asking the Department of Defense, what are you doing with these authorities? Are you doing what we intended? Are you doing enough? And that manifested itself in meetings, either between staff or with members or formal hearings, or it led to more language.
Yeah.
Right? Letters or more provisions and more NDAAs trying to drive the Department of Defense to do whatever it was that Congress was envisioned. And so all of that now, that regulatory process, that oversight process, that absorption process in the executive branch is just turning on now. And it's both for DOD, and like you said, there's Department of State got its own authorization in here, and intelligence community got their authorization. Everybody is absorbing and starting to react. So, you know, another thing that's gonna happen soon, on the based on the date we're recording here, is we're going to see maybe a conclusion to the fiscal year 24's appropriation cycle as well.
We can hope.
We can hope. So, you know, all of this work went into this NDAA, and we talked previously about it having its own funding tables. What's the influence of this NDAA typically on the appropriations process?
So it depends on the year. I would suggest this year, not as much as other years in the immediate past. Right? So if you look at the last 2 years, the president, the administration sent over the president's budget, the request, right? And Congress was saying, you know, we're not so sure about that. We may want to increase that. And then the NDAAs came out. Now, here's the important thing about the NDAA. When the NDAA passes the House and the Senate, even before it passes everybody, it is invariably bipartisan, right? It gets a lot of bipartisan support. And so when that NDAA comes out with defense authorized funding that is higher than the president's budget, what it is saying is there is bipartisan support to increase the budget, right? And that frames the debate because you already know that you've got votes on both sides to do something, right? And that's what happened in the House and Senate last year and the year before that. It framed the debate of roughly how much to raise it by, and the ultimate appropriation dollars came in roughly at those levels. This year seems to be a very different kettle of fish because the appropriations debate is at a much higher level, at a leadership level, and a much higher leadership president negotiation. And there is within parties a lot of disagreement. And so the top line negotiation for defense and non-defense was really taken out of the orbit of influence of the NDAA.
So there's lots of numbers in here. Big numbers, top lines for the Department of Defense, small numbers, individual projects favored by members of Congress, cuts to programs made in the request by the president and by the Department of Defense, all in this authorization bill, but take it all with a grain of salt, because it's we have to wait to see what the appropriators do, and they're under no legal requirement, or even cultural requirement, to follow what was in that NDAA.
Yeah, and I would say take it with more than just a grain of salt, right? When the president's budget request comes over, that's not what's going to be enacted. It's the base of it. 90% is very similar. You know, there might be some playing here and there, some programs cut and all of that, or added. But you now have the framework of conversation. The NDAA definitely in some years has a lot more influence than others. But there are occasions when the appropriators and authorizers do have some conversations, right? They're very different types of staffers very often, because they're very different jobs with very, very different priorities, right? One is policy, one is, you know, pencil sharpening for dollars. But there is conversation, and there is an interplay that does take place in both ways, I would suggest.
So the other product that we'll see, hopefully we see this final appropriations bill. The other product we should be seeing in the next couple of months, because we're at the new year here, is the president's budget request for fiscal year 25.
Correct.
How much in that budget request typically reflects what was in an NDAA?
So it depends. So for example, last year, Cybercom was given a lot more authorities, and there was some consolidation. Some of that authority that was given to Cybercom came from the NDAA, and some of their missions and responsibilities come from the NDAA. So when a budget request comes over from Cybercom, while the NDAA isn't influencing directly, you will ask for this much money, the whole request of Cybercom and the consolidation of authorities and missions, a lot of it emanated from NDA language that created the structure of Cybercom today.
So there is some ability to react.
Space Force, there's another perfect example.
And push it out even in the next budget request. So we're running out of time. So let's close up with the question of, you know, how should, this is a very complicated topic. We touched a lot of things. Each of those provisions has a lot of depth to it and a lot of potential implications. So how do NDIA members think about absorbing this bill and everything that's in it, right?
So, yeah, it's a great question. It is very difficult. This is almost all that I do, and yet I find it very difficult to track everything over the years and to drill into 2,100 pages, right? So I would say the first thing is hire someone like me. That's what we do, right? Listen to podcasts like this, right? This is what we go over it. It's hard. And it's hard to track the entire process and then to influence the process. Definitely take advantage of NDIA and places like that, and podcasts and you know, Bloomberg, if you have that. Talk to your members.
Members of Congress.
Absolutely. Talk to members of Congress.
And their staff.
And their staff, for sure. More likely their staff, very often, and their staff, or even committee staff. That's another way to do it. And the other thing is, we talked about how to access some of these, right? Congress.gov or just the website. I think that is critically important. So for example, if you are very interested in hypersonics, pull up the PDF and do a word search on it, and you will find the hypersonics provisions. If you are very interested in quantum, do that.
And with definitely the communities, the working groups, the divisions, the chapters at NDIA, have people have meetings where they do absorb, discuss the implications. You're very involved, for example, in the procurement division, and those folks get really into the weeds of the legalese of the contracting provisions and how that's going to affect defense industry. The small business division does a lot of work in tracking all of the small business provisions we've talked about. So then, you know, NDIA and ETI can be helpful in this absorbing of what's in the National Defense Authorization.
Absolutely. The last procurement division meeting that we had, we went through about 25 provisions, of the 25 most important provisions for procurement. And I'm sure all the divisions are doing things
similar
to that.
And most people manage to stay awake through the whole thing.
There's coffee.
It's coffee.
There's coffee. Okay.
So with that, I want to thank Moshe for helping us sort of get to some level of understanding of what the NDA is and walking us through some of the interesting provisions in it. And I appreciate all of your expertise that you've provided to NDIA over the years.
It is always a pleasure to be here.
And with that, I want to thank you all for joining me for another episode of Emerging Tech Horizons podcast. I want to highlight a couple of things that the Emerging Technologies Institute is working on right now. The second annual Emerging Technologies Conference is going to be held August 7th through 9th in 2024 at the Washington Convention Center. Information on registration, sponsorship, displays, exhibits is all going to be available on our website soon. We have a drumbeat between us and NDIA of events, like conferences, like webinars, short courses that are always coming out. Please check out our websites for those upcoming events and webinars. Thank you so much for tuning into this week's podcast. If you enjoyed this podcast, don't forget to hit the like button and subscribe to our channel to stay up to date with all of our latest content.